This morning I'd like to talk about the Mosaic Law in a little bit more detail. Last Sunday we mentioned that there is a traditional method of distinguishing between different categories of Old Testament law. That traditional method is the threefold method of moral, ceremonial, and civil law. And what I'd like to do is to examine that method a little bit more, to look at some other alternatives as well. Before we do that, though, let's look in our Bibles. Let's start with, I'm going to look at various passages here in the Pentateuch that deal with the giving of the law. Let's start with Exodus 20. You begin in Exodus 20 with the giving of the Ten Commandments. I'm not going to read those, but just simply draw your attention to them. Notice after the giving of the Ten Commandments, verses 1 through 17, if you keep reading, you have a paragraph dealing with the people's fear of the holiness of God because of the thunderings and the lightnings. Immediately after this paragraph, in verse 22, God gives the law of the altar to Moses. The law of the altar is that the Israelites, if they make an altar, it is not to be made with hewn stone, that is, not chiseled. Otherwise, by lifting up their tool upon it, they would profane the altar of God, verse 25. Nor, verse 26, must the altar have steps. If the altar has steps, then the nakedness of the priest would be exposed upon it. Interestingly, you have right here in this one chapter, you have what is considered to be moral law, the Ten Commandments, but also ceremonial law, that is the law of the altar. But then you keep reading, chapter 21, verses 1 through 11, you have the laws dealing with slaves or servants. If you buy a Hebrew servant, you shall let him go after 6 years. There are laws dealing with what shall be done to the servant's wife and his children. If he had betrothed the wife after his servitude, then the wife and the children belong to the master. Verses 11 through 27 deals with various forms of murder, premeditated murder, manslaughter, various applications of the sixth commandment. Verses 28 through 36 deals with animals that are prone to goring people. An oxen that gores a man or a woman to death shall be put to death. The owner also has to bear some responsibility in this if the animal had been known to do this in the past and the owner still failed to properly control the animal or keep him confined, then the owner shall also be put to death. Chapter 22 deals with restitution of stolen property. Then there are various ceremonial laws given at the end of the chapter concerning the firstborn and so on. Chapter 23 focuses more on ceremonial law. You have the Sabbath and the three annual feasts. And then at the end of that, then you have the renewal of the covenant or the inauguration of the covenant in chapter 24. This just gives you an overview of the different kinds of laws that are given in the Mosaic Law. If you turn to Leviticus, we see some additional types of law. Start with Leviticus 11. Leviticus 11 is about the distinctions between clean and unclean foods. Animals that divide the hoof and that chew the cud are clean and may be eaten. Animals that do not qualify are unclean. There's a whole listing here of specific types of animals, the whole chapter. Chapter 12 of Leviticus deals with the next few chapters deal with rituals for cleansing. Chapter 12 is the first example of cleansing. There's a ritual for purification after giving birth. In chapter 13 and 14, there is a very long section dealing with lepers. The laws concerning leprosy and how leprous garments are to be cleansed, how lepers are to be healed and cleansed, and so on, and how their houses are to be cleansed. Leviticus 15 deals with various bodily discharges, menstruation, various other things, the offering of the right animals to provide cleansing for those. 16 is the Day of Atonement, and so on. I'm going to skip now to chapter 18. Leviticus 18 deals with various laws concerning sexual morality. Throughout this chapter, there's a reference to uncovering the nakedness, which is a euphemism for sexual intercourse. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife, and so on. The whole chapter deals with various forms of sexual sin. Skip now to Deuteronomy. We see some other law passages here. Start with Deuteronomy chapter 13. Deuteronomy 13 deals with dealing with covenant breakers. A covenant breaker isn't just somebody who commits a sin, nor is a covenant breaker a criminal. A covenant breaker is someone who goes and worships a false god. And this whole chapter here deals with the law concerning apostates or covenant breakers. For example, verse 6, if your brother, the son of your mother, etc., etc., says, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known, neither you or your fathers, of the gods of the people which are all around you, then verse 8, you shall not consent to him or listen to him, nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. But your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So the law of stoning as the proper way of dealing with apostates. Then you have chapter 14, some more laws concerning clean and unclean food. You also have verses 22 to 29, the last half of chapter 14, dealing with tithing. When you come into the land and God blesses your grain and your fields, then you are to bring the first fruits into the Lord and to give them to God so that the Levites, who have no portion or inheritance in the land, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates, that they also might be supplied. Deuteronomy 15 deals with the cancellation of debts every 7 years, generosity to the poor, various other laws, the law of the firstborn at the very end, verse 19 through 23. Deuteronomy 16 deals with the various feasts. 17 continues again dealing with apostasy, a man or a woman who transgresses the covenant and worships a false god. Then 17 verse 14 deals with the laws concerning kings. When you enter into the land and God gives you a king, then these kings must take care not to multiply horses for themselves or to multiply wives for themselves and so on. Those are the very commandments that Solomon violated, if you remember, in 1 Kings chapter 10 and 11. Deuteronomy 18 also has various laws dealing with the priests and the Levites. Chapter 19 deals with the cities of refuge. These cities of refuge are the way that God was limiting and controlling the practice of blood vengeance that was found among the ancient Near Eastern culture at this time. If a family member was killed, whether premeditated murder or not, the rest of the family had an obligation, according to these ancient customs of blood relatives and so on, to avenge the blood of the slain relative. And of course, this was very destructive, because then as soon as you avenge the blood of the relative, then what happens? Then they have to avenge back, so it just keeps going. And so God provided a way of limiting this by establishing cities of refuge for a man who had talks about verse 4, whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally, not having hated him in the past. So that would be manslaughter. Notice also in verse 14 you have a commandment here, you shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set. These landmarks establish the boundaries of your inheritance. You can't move your boundary marker over a little bit in order to extend your inheritance, and thus stealing from the other person. Then there are laws concerning witnesses. There have to be two or three witnesses to verify charges. Now Deuteronomy 20 is interesting. Deuteronomy 20 deals with cherem warfare. Cherem warfare was total destruction warfare. In ancient Israel, when they went into the land to destroy the Canaanites, they didn't practice warfare according to the Geneva Accord. They didn't say, well, you know, only those who are in combat will be targeted, will spare civilians. They didn't say, when we take captives, we'll make sure that we feed them and protect them and have a legitimate trial. No. They didn't say we'll spare the women and the children. No, this is divine judgment here. And God was raising up the Israelites in order to punish the Canaanites. Remember, way back in Genesis, God told Abraham that the sin of the Amorite is not yet full. So God was allowing the Canaanites to become even more wicked in their idolatry and all the pagan practices that were involved in that in terms of offering their children to gods and so on. And the Israelites then came into the land to destroy the Canaanites completely. Men, women, children, property, everything was destroyed. It was all placed under the ban. The ban means that it's all devoted to destruction. So these are the principles governing warfare. Then in chapter 21, you have the law concerning unsolved murder. What do you do if you find a man lying in the field, dead, and no one knows who the murderer is? Well, there's this ritual that is to be done. Verse 3, it shall be that the elders of the city nearest to the slain man will take a heifer which has not been worked and which has not pulled with a yoke, and the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley flowing with water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Why? This was to provide atonement for the land, because the blood defiled the land, which is the inheritance of God. Verse 8, provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people. And atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the land. So you shall put away, for the blood. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. Verses 15 through 17 is interesting. Here you have the rights of the firstborn concerning the inheritance. The firstborn is to be given a double portion of the inheritance. It's important also that if a man has two wives, one is loved, the other is not, he is not to show favoritism towards the wife he loves, but rather his firstborn, regardless of which wife he is from, is to be given the rights of the inheritance. And so on. We could go on and on and on. So what I've done here is just simply to give you a survey, an overview of the various kinds of laws that are a part of the Mosaic Law. And the difficulty, of course, is how do we know which of these laws are still applicable today? Some of the ones that we looked at, you could say it makes sense to think maybe there is some applicability. If we're talking about the laws concerning murder and restitution for theft and so on, you could say that doesn't seem to be so connected with Israel's identity as a holy nation, as a theocracy, that it would be wrong to take those principles perhaps and apply them in our culture today. It might be plausible to go that way, you could say. But then there are other laws here that are clearly don't have any bearing upon our modern culture. if we find a dead body, we're not obligated to go out and break the heifer's neck in the valley, because that was connected specifically with Israel's inheritance in the land and atoning for the land to make sure the land was not did not suffer the weight of God's wrath for the shedding of innocent blood. And the other commandments too, clean and unclean food. Very clearly in the New Testament, Jesus and the apostles taught that those particular commandments are no longer binding on the church. Remember the Council of Jerusalem. In the early church, most of the Christians of the early church were Jews. But there was this debate as to whether the Gentiles had to keep those commandments. The Jewish Christians still practiced the ritual law. They still kept the various feasts. They honored the fact that the temple was still standing and so on. But what about these Gentiles who are coming into the church? Should they be required to circumcise their children? Should they be required to abstain from clean and from unclean food and so on? And so the Council of Jerusalem provided a compromise, which basically said, no, the Gentiles are not required to do those things except for some of the basics. They can't commit adultery. They can't eat meat that has blood in it or things strangled and so on. And this was a way then of providing peace in the church at that time. But clearly, now that the temple has been destroyed, there is no need even to keep some of those compromise commands that were included, such as eating meat with blood in it, because that it was connected with the altar, the presence of the altar. And Jesus also taught, he said in Mark 7, he said, it is not what goes into a man, but what comes out of a man that defiles him. And Mark makes a little comment in his parentheses. He says, by saying this, Jesus declared all foods to be clean. And also Peter, in Acts 10, he had a vision as Cornelius and his men were about to come into his house to ask him to teach him the way of salvation. God came to Peter in a dream. Peter was in a trance, and he saw the sheet coming out of heaven. And the sheet had all kinds of unclean animals in it, animals that were forbidden in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy and so on. And what did God say to Peter? He said, rise and eat. And Peter says, no, Lord, I've never eaten anything unclean. And what does God say in response? He says, what God has called clean, you should not call unclean. And so the Lord then is beginning to show that there is a transition here in redemptive history in some of these commandments. So there are a lot of different laws connected with the Mosaic economy. And the question then is, how do we know which ones are still binding and which ones are not? That's the bottom line question that the church has always struggled with. Struggled with that back in the time of the apostles. And it struggles with it today as we debate with Seventh-day Adventists, for example, who believe that the clean and unclean distinctions are still valid. Of course, they argue for them based on the health benefits of abstaining from unclean food, which was never the reason given in the Old Testament. But still, they're appealing to various aspects of the Old Covenant. They observe the Sabbath on the seventh day. We have a similar debate with theonomists. Theonomists are arguing that all of the judicial laws of the Old Covenant, especially the penal commandments concerning punishment for murder, punishment for idolatry, punishment for sorcery, all of these commands, adultery, they are all punishable by death in the Old Testament. And theonomy argues that the state today has an obligation to enforce those commands and to apply the very same punishments that were given in the Old Testament. And so these debates continue to rage. What about the seventh or the fourth commandment, keeping the Sabbath holy? Some Christians think that that was part of the ceremonial law and is no longer binding in the church at all. They're the opposite extreme of the Seventh-day Adventists, who say it should be kept on the seventh day. Most people in the church today say it has no binding authority at all. And then there are those of us who hold to the Reformed view, which is that it's still binding, but it's binding in a new covenant form on the first day of the week. So all of these questions are very difficult to resolve. It's the question of the relationship between the Old and the New Testament. It's the question of the relationship between Israel's theocratic status as a nation that was redeemed by God and set apart as a holy nation, and how that relates to the nations of the earth today. Is there any relationship? And these questions of continuity and discontinuity, of the relationships between the Old and the New, between Israel and the nations today, these questions are very troubling and difficult to resolve. So what I want to do then is to show you that there have been different answers given as to how to try to resolve these questions. And the first standard approach that has been given is the one found in the Westminster Confession in chapter 19. The Westminster Confession argues that the laws of Israel, the Mosaic Law, can be broken down into three main categories. The first would be the moral law. The moral law would be those commandments that are still binding regardless of any changes that may have occurred in redemptive history. For example, to worship God alone. It doesn't matter whether you're living in Israel or whether you're living in America in the 20th century. You have an obligation to worship the true and living God and not to worship idols. The second category of law, according to the Westminster Confession, is the ceremonial law. The ceremonial law deals with those aspects of the law that foreshadowed the work of Christ. So you have the Passover. You have all the sacrifices that were offered. These are part of the ceremonial law that picture and foreshadow the coming of Christ. And therefore, these laws too are no longer binding. Now, in a sense, they're binding because they've been fulfilled by Christ. And so we still observe them in the sense that we worship Jesus Christ and we trust in Him and we acknowledge His blood as being the only sacrifice for sin. But in terms of the form in which they were given in the Old Testament, we're not required to go out and sacrifice animals and so on. The third category of law is the civil or judicial law. And these laws, according to the Westminster Confession, are the laws that deal with Israel as a nation. The laws that govern Israel's civil relationship and their civil government, their polity. I would just like to read a little bit from the Westminster Confession so you can see this here. It's chapter 19. If you have a hymn book, it's page 859. We'll read the first five paragraphs here. God gave to Adam a law as a covenant of works, by which he bound him and all his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience, promised life upon the fulfilling and threatened death upon the breach of it, and endued him with power and ability to keep it. This law, after his fall, continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness. Notice that statement there, a perfect rule of righteousness. That is their definition of the moral law. And as such, was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments and written in 2 tables, the first 4 commandments containing our duty towards God, and the other 6 our duty to man. Besides this law, okay, this refers back to paragraph 2. So in addition to this law in paragraph 2, which is commonly called moral, so paragraph 2 was a definition of the moral law, okay? Perfect rule of righteousness delivered on Mount Sinai and 10 commandments. Now, paragraph 3. In addition to the moral law, God was pleased to give to the people of Israel, as a church under age, ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances. Typical here doesn't mean typical the way we usually mean it. Oh, that's typical, right? It means it's typological, okay? Containing several typological ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, His graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, and partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws are now abrogated under the New Testament. So according to the Westminster Confession, the first category of law, moral law, is a perfect rule of righteousness, and it continues. The ceremonial law is typological, prefiguring Christ, and therefore it's abrogated now that Christ has come. And then, paragraph 4, we come to the third type of law. To them also, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now, further than the general equity thereof may require. We'll talk about that a little bit more, the general equity. Paragraph 5, the moral law doth forever bind all, as well justified persons as others, to the obedience thereof, and that not only in regard of the matter contained in it, but also in respect of the authority of God the Creator, who gave it. Neither doth Christ in the gospel any way dissolve, but much strengthen this obligation. So paragraph 5 simply goes back and looks at the first type of law, the moral law, and says that it's forever binding. And it binds even believers who are justified. This traditional breakdown of the law is the standard understanding then of how to sort between those laws that are still binding and those that are not in the ones that we read. We looked at all these different types of laws. You have to ask yourself, first of all, is it part of the ceremonial law? Does it prefigure Christ and his work? And we would say a lot of those did, right? The ones concerning cleansing from sin, the law of the cleansing after childbirth and various things like that, they deal with the cleansing of sin, or at least as sin was pictured at that time in redemptive history, in terms of being a physical uncleanness, which was a picture of the internal uncleanness of sin. So those, according to the confession, and I think the confession is right at that point, are no longer binding. But what about the other two possibilities? There's the moral law and the civil law. Now here's where it gets a little bit complicated, because according to the confession, the moral law and the civil law are not completely distinct. They're somehow related in a certain way. Paragraph 4. To them also as a body politic he gave sundry judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now further than the general equity thereof may require. The concept of general equity, according to the confession, is basically this. If you draw two circles, remember like the Venn diagrams in high school? If you draw two circles with a little bit of overlap between them, one circle is called the moral law, the other circle is called the civil law, the place where they overlap, you can shade it in, would be called the general equity. The general equity of any given civil law would be that aspect of the law which is still binding because that aspect is part of the moral law. Let me give you an example of how that might work. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 8. Deuteronomy 22:8 says, "When you build a new house, then you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring guilt of bloodshed on your household if anyone falls from it." Now this commandment here is a command that would not be applicable today if we tried to keep it literally, because in our culture today, the roof of the house is not considered to be a place where we normally go. Of course, in the ancient world, the roof of the house was flat, and it would have been a place to enjoy the evening and so on. And so in that day, then, it was important to put up a fence, a railing, around the edge of your roof so that nobody would fall off and get killed. And so the general equity, then, of this commandment would be not that we have to build parapets today around the roof of our houses, but rather that we must take care to not only keep the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, by refraining from actually killing somebody, but we also need to take steps to take reasonable precautions to prevent someone from accidentally killing themselves because of some danger in our property. So what kind of applications could you think of today that might take that general equity principle and apply it today? Barry?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of cases where the swimming pool comes involved and you have a fence around.
Right. So if you have a swimming pool and you have little kids, it'd be a good idea to put a fence around it.
But you're not talking about us just putting a fence around our swimming pool.
Right.
You're talking about the state requiring us to put a fence around our swimming pool. That's
no,
what
I'm
this
not.
Is about, right?
I'm not really dealing with that, actually.
Okay.
When
you're talking about the confluence there between the civil and the moral,
I assume
you're talking about the state looking to the Bible for principles that it needs to enact.
Yeah. I'm not really dealing with that particular point yet of what should the state do. I'm just trying to point out the concept of general equity first, okay? Because it's easy with this verse.
I know, but that's a civil law of Israel. That was something they were required to do by law.
Right. the another possible application of Deuteronomy 22:8 would be when you mop your floor, right? Let's say you are a janitor at a school or some place of work, you know, where there's a lot of people walking down the hallways. What do they usually do? They put up those little yellow signs, right? So that you don't just come running through and then fall on your head. So this is a way of preventing somebody from falling into a danger to their life that you had, in a sense, created. You created this danger, and therefore you need to avoid or take precautions to prevent that danger from resulting in harm. That's the concept of general equity that we're talking about here. Now we could apply it more generally and ask, are there civil laws in the Mosaic Code that deal with the way the state ought to operate? Are there civil laws in the Mosaic Code that contain general equity in them that should be applied today by our states, by the states and the nations of this world? And that's where we get into the whole issue of theonomy. Because theonomy is the position that attempts to develop this concept of general equity much more than the Westminster Confession itself does. The Westminster Confession itself pretty much says that the judicial laws of Israel are over. If you read it again, chapter 19, yeah, it says expired, right? It says chapter 19, verse or paragraph 4, they expired together with the state of that people. So when the state of Israel expired in AD 70, the judicial laws that governed the state of Israel in AD 70 also expired at that point, not obliging any other now, okay? Any other meaning any other body politic. And then this last sentence, further than the general equity there may require, that seems to sort of allow now for some possible leftover application that does apply. And that's the point where the theonomic position, it takes that one little sentence and it runs with it and it applies it even more in more depth. So the theonomic position then, in a sense, what the theonomists do is they take the traditional threefold breakdown of the law and they reduce it to two. Theonomists argue that the civil and judicial law that was given to Israel is, in effect, a part of the moral law. Theonomy argues that there are two categories of law. There's the moral law and the ceremonial law. The moral law is based on God's justice, and the ceremonial law is based upon God's mercy. I'm reading here from Theonomy and Christian Ethics by Greg Bonson. He writes, "The following outline can briefly summarize that rationale, namely, a distinction between laws reflecting God's justice and those based upon his redemptive purposes, that is, moral law and restorative law, the former defining sin, while the latter aims at salvation from sin. The moral law reflects God's absolute righteousness and judgment. Restorative law reflects the mercy of God and his electing love. It reflects the Messiah's saving person work and redemptive economy, but not God's absolute justice. This is on page 214. Having defined the law then as having only these two categories, where does the civil or judicial law end up? The civil or judicial law ends up under category one as being the moral law. Now, in a sense, that way of doing it is not completely contrary to the Westminster Confession because of the fact that the Confession adds this concept about general equity. The difference is how do you define this general equity? The Westminster Divines themselves defined general equity as being the way I defined it here, the overlap between the moral and the civil. So the question would be asked, you take any given civil law and you would ask, is there an underlying moral principle that derives from the unchanging moral law? And if it does, then that aspect of it is binding because it is the moral law. Theonomy, though, takes those two overlapping portions between moral and civil, and it pretty much does it like this. You see how now we have a much bigger area of overlap. We have the same two circles, moral and civil, and the middle part here where the overlap is also the general equity. There's a much greater area of overlap between the moral law and the civil law in the theonomic view. And as I say, it's not really a major change from what the Confession already has. The Confession establishes this concept, and then theonomy simply takes it and expands it even more. The difference, though, is that the Confession defines, or the Westminster Divines define general equity as being the underlying moral principle, whereas theonomy, because it does not see this third category here of the judicial laws that expired together with the state of that people, it allows for this overlap here between the moral and the civil law to be much greater. And therefore, what is left here in this little white spot here, the white spot of the civil law that isn't part of the moral law according to theonomy. The only thing that's left here in this white spot would be the cultural form. The cultural form in which the law was given. Okay? Again, go back to the parapet law in Deuteronomy 22:8. In Deuteronomy 22:8, the parapet law was given in a cultural form that was applicable to Israel's culture in the ancient Near East at that time, in which roofs were places where people would go up and have hospitality and so on. That cultural form is no longer in effect today. Or if it was, I guess we could apply that directly, if there was a country where this was done. But since it's not done today, since that cultural form is no longer in effect, we have to find the parallel to that in our culture today. And the parallel to that in our culture today is the swimming pool example that Barry gave. Now, so you see the difference then between these two approaches. They're similar, but they're also different. Theonomy is taking the Westminster Confession's idea and pushing it in a stronger theonomic direction than the Confession itself. But it's picking up on something that was already established in the Confession in terms of that concept of general equity. And so what I want to argue then is that we need to go beyond the Westminster Confession, and we need to come up with a better way of categorizing the Old Testament laws. This standard way of the threefold moral, ceremonial, and civil law is not completely wrong. There is truth in it, and you can see the truth in it, especially when you look at the fact that, yes, there are moral laws that are binding in all ages. You know, it's always wrong to murder. It's always wrong to worship a false god. Yes, there are ceremonial laws in the Old Testament that deal with the foreshadowing of Christ's work, and yes, there are judicial laws that deal with the punishment for sin and so on, and the theocracy of Israel. That is a valid understanding, but it has weaknesses in it. The primary weakness of the Westminster Confession's approach is that it views these three types of laws as being three separate bins, if you will. So you're going through the list that we looked at, let's say just all those examples that we read at the beginning, and you have to ask yourself, which one is it? One, two, or three, right? Well, let's see, it doesn't fit one, doesn't fit two, okay, it must be three. It doesn't fit two, doesn't fit three, maybe it's one. And you just go through and you classify them, like you have three, let's say you have three trash cans right in front of you. One says moral, the other says ceremonial, the other says civil, and you go through your Bible and you cut each verse up into a little, you know, like a fortune cookie slip of paper, and you cut it up and you say, okay, which trash bin does this one go? Oh yeah, this goes in one. Okay, and then the next one, which one does this go? That goes into two. As if you could classify it so rigidly in that way. Of course, the confession itself recognizes there's a weakness in that, because then it takes this concept of general equity and shows that there is some overlap between the civil and the moral. In fact, it even did that with the ceremonial, if you recall. In the ceremonial law, it said there are even some ceremonial laws that are partly prefiguring Christ, but also partly containing moral principles. Right? So even the confession is recognizing that this traditional threefold category, it doesn't really work perfectly. And so you have to kind of qualify it by adding these overlap concepts and these Venn diagrams and stuff. Theonomy simply takes that basic breakdown of the threefold law, simplifies it into two, and makes the general equity everything except for the cultural form, which is pushing it beyond what the confession originally said, but is still working within the basic framework of what the confession said. So I'm going to argue then for, let's start over. Let's do another system. I'm going to put it down like this. Instead of having three trash cans with labels on them and then trying to divide them up, and then stepping back and saying, wait, that doesn't work, let's try the Venn diagrams. Instead of doing that, let's do this. Draw a table with two columns and two rows. The first column will be called moral. The second column will be called typological. The first row we'll call cult, and the second row we'll call culture. Now let me define these four terms. Moral we're defining as that which is always in effect and always binding. Typological we're defining as that which points ahead to the realities to come. Now, notice we don't call it ceremonial, we call it typological, because there are laws that do not point ahead to the redemptive work of Christ, per se, but they're still pointing ahead to something. Okay? The ceremonial laws defined by the Westminster Confession is just those laws that point ahead to the work of Christ and his death on the cross and so on. But there are laws that point ahead not only to the work of Christ and dying for our sins and being the final sacrifice, but also in pointing ahead to the work of Christ as being our King. And specifically, the kingly office of Christ as it will be accomplished and fulfilled when Christ returns. When Christ returns, the kingly office of Christ will be executed in judgment. In fact, we're going to talk about that in the morning sermon in Revelation 14 through 20. The kingly office of Christ in harvesting the nations and trampling the winepress of the wrath of God. So typological then is a bigger category than ceremonial. What about cult and culture? Well, let me just simplify that by using terms you're more familiar with. Cult deals with the priestly office, and culture deals with the kingly office. Now we have four types of laws here. We have moral laws that deal with cult. What kind of laws would fit into that category, the priestly function of Israel. Moral laws that deal with Israel's priestly function. Okay, to worship God alone. So the first commandment, right? Under typological priestly or typological cultic, what kind of laws would fit there?
Clean and unclean laws.
Okay, let's just put down the traditional term. Let's just put down ceremonial as it's traditionally defined. So that would be all the sacrifices and so on, right? And you could include the clean and unclean food, I guess, there too. What about moral and culture? What are we going to put under this category here? Moral laws that deal with culture.
Specific laws on what to do in cases of murder.
Okay. So let's put down the commandments dealing with, like, let's say the sixth commandment, thou shalt not murder, various commands like that. Basically, it's the last six commandments. And then we could do the same thing up here for moral and cult. The moral laws that deal with the cult would just be the first four commandments. What about typological laws that deal with culture? Okay, I'll just hand out the handout here. Make it easier, huh? Well, this category here, the typological laws that deal with culture, this is the big one that deals with theonomy. This is where the theonomists don't have a category. This is where the traditional threefold categorization of the law, according to the Westminster Confession, is lacking. You see? The traditional threefold system would be this one up here is the moral law. That's the moral laws that deal with cult. And, the moral laws that deal with cult. And then you have the ceremonial law here, typological laws that deal with culture. But then this third category, the ceremonial law, the judicial law or civil law, where does it fit? Does it fit here with moral laws that deal with culture? Or does it fit here with typological laws that deal with culture? Well, traditionally, it's been sort of both, right?
Theonomists have looked at it that way, right?
Yeah, theonomists have looked at it that way, but even the Westminster Confession kind of allows for it to be viewed that way in some sense, because of general equity. And that's where I think the failure is. And this understanding then of the law helps to clarify that. So the typological laws that deal with culture, that is with the kingly office, are the laws that deal with the enforcement of the first four commandments. The king in Israel was the one who had the responsibility to enforce the first four commandments. Remember, the king is the one who, let's say you're talking about the time of Josiah. Josiah was the reformer king. He's the one who said, I'm going to bring Israel back to her covenant faithfulness in the area of the cult. In the area of the cult, Israel had become apostate. The temple was had fallen into disuse, and the law of God itself had been forgotten, been buried somewhere in the temple. Nobody knew where it was. The priests weren't teaching it. The priests were busy being preoccupied with worshiping false gods and building altars to all kinds of pagan deities. And so Josiah, the king, was the reformer king, and he said, I'm going to reform the cult. And he brought Israel back to covenant faithfulness in the area of the cult. David and Solomon, they were the ones who built the temple. David didn't build it. He prepared for the building of it by preparing the materials and by establishing the blueprint and so on that God revealed to him. And Solomon was the one who actually built it. But the king, again, is the one who is enforcing and implementing and instructing the process of keeping the first four commandments that deal with the cult. And so this, then, is the area, this fourth box here, the typological laws dealing with the kingly office or with culture. This is the area where theonomy gets confused. And the confusion, I believe, is latent within the traditional threefold breakdown. The traditional threefold breakdown itself doesn't allow your mind to clearly understand that there is this fourth category of laws that are, in a sense, ceremonial. All of these laws dealing with the enforcement of the penal code, the laws concerning the subjugation of idolatry, the laws concerning the conquest of Canaan, all of these commandments that deal with the enforcement of the first four commandments, they are, in a sense, ceremonial. They have a ceremonial aspect to them if we define ceremonial as being anything that is typological and is concluded when Christ comes and fulfills it. But since we have defined ceremonial from the get-go as being just those laws that deal with foreshadowing Christ's redemptive work, we miss this whole category, this whole specific area. So the cultural typological segment of the Mosaic Law really is the key to responding to theonomy and showing that theonomy is an error.
It's interesting because throughout Chronicles and Kings, the writer describes whether a king was a good king or a bad king based basically on that square.
That's right.
Over there.
That's
whether
right.
Whether they cut down, you know, destroyed the high places and cut down the poles.
That's right.
And killed the idolaters and so forth.
Exactly. And David and Solomon's glory was that they were the ones who established the temple system and so on. So this fourth category here of the typological cultural law, that is typological laws that deal with the kingly office of Christ, typological laws that foreshadow the kingly office of Christ in his enforcement at the last day of the first four commandments, that is the category that the traditional threefold category and the theonomic twofold categorization both miss. Like I said, there is truth in the traditional threefold system. The traditional threefold system, I'm not throwing it out completely and saying it's all hogwash. There's truth in it. The problem is that it lends itself towards a misunderstanding. And that is where theonomy gets going, is because of that misunderstanding. It then takes that misunderstanding and runs with it and develops further errors from it. Any questions about this?
What about laws that aren't included in the Mosaic Covenant? Like I was looking at Genesis 9 where it says after God removes the clean unclean food distinction with Noah, he then says, but you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, with its blood. Mm-hmm. That commandment was carried over in the New Testament by the Jerusalem Council. Wouldn't that still apply? And where does that fit into this scheme?
Yeah.
How do you fit something?
Okay, I'll show you. That's a good question. The question is Genesis 9. In Genesis 9, what verse?
Verse 4.
Can you read it?
But you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, with its blood. And it comes right after where the Lord removes the clean, unclean distinction with regard to food that Noah had been under while he was in the ark.
Okay. Remember our little diagram here? This diagram is the answer to everything. For the tape, this is the diagram that shows the whole flow of the history of redemption with the five epics of redemptive history: the pre-fall epic, the patriarchal epic, Israel, epic 3, the church age, epic 4, and the eternal state, epic 5. And in our understanding of this, as we've talked about it, we've focused primarily on the fact that Israel is a theocracy, just as heaven will be a theocracy. And therefore, we've talked about this concept of intrusion. An intrusion is that heaven won't wait. The principles and powers of the age to come have intruded into the midst of history in the Israelite theocracy. What happens when heaven comes in? Right here, this line right here. The kingly office of Christ, right? Christ comes as the conquering king, and what does he do at this point? He conquers his enemies. He conquers all unbelievers. He destroys the beast and the false prophet, and all unbelievers are cast into the lake of fire. As a result, then, heaven is the place in which righteousness dwells, and the new heavens and the new earth contain no enemies, no sinners, no beasts, no harlots, no tares. It's a place of purity. Well, that's exactly what happened when Israel was inaugurated. The kingly office of Christ. This pen is kind of running out here. The kingly office of Christ was expressed in the conquest of the Canaanites. And the Canaanites were wiped out, establishing therefore a holy ground, the land. There were no sinners in that land, at least typologically. Now, in reality, there were. But in terms of the picture that God is trying to paint on his canvas of redemptive history, the picture is no unrighteous people may dwell in this land. No idolaters may live. Even if an Israelite commits idolatry, he has to be stoned in order to eliminate idolatry from the land. Because Israel is a picture of the new heavens and the new earth. Now, to get to Arthur's question, what about Genesis 9, verse 4? Well, the answer is that the ark was also an intrusion. Another intrusion there. Another expression of kingly conquest here in the flood. Just as heaven will be inaugurated with the conquest and Israel was inaugurated with the conquest, so the ark was inaugurated with the conquest of the flood. The world was destroyed. All unbelievers were wiped out, leaving only a holy place called the ark. The ark then was also a theocracy, a miniature theocracy in which only there was holiness, only righteous people dwelled. And therefore, just as you have at the end of the theocratic era with Israel, you have what? At the end of the theocratic era with Israel, you have Acts 10. God comes to Peter and says, "Rise, kill, and eat. The clean-unclean distinction is no longer applicable." So also at the end of the ark, when the inhabitants of the ark come out of the ark, God says, "Now you can eat all food. The clean-unclean distinction is no longer applicable." And why was the clean-unclean distinction important in the ark? It was important because of the fact that God commanded Noah to take 7 of the animals that were to be used for sacrifice. And so the sacrificial system was being anticipated here that would come up again in Israel. The ark, then, was a miniature theocracy that foreshadowed the coming of Israel. So the flood is parallel to the conquest, and the removal of the clean-unclean distinction at the end of the ark is parallel to the removal of the clean-unclean distinction at the end of the theocracy of Israel in Acts 10.
So my question was, wouldn't the prohibition against eating flesh with its blood still be applicable because it was given at the end of that period in the inauguration of a period similar to our own period?
That's a good question, too. That's because even during this whole period here, from the fall all the way up until the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, there was an altar community living in the world. There was an altar. Okay? And that altar was the key to everything. God's people worshipped at the altar. They sacrificed at the altar. This was where God dwelled with his people. He met with his people. He came and he met with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. This altar is also a theocratic expression. It is the powers of the age to come being expressed here in the altar. That altar thing existed even in those periods of redemptive history, such as this one here and this one here. for the tape, I'm pointing to the era from the fall up to the ark, and then the era after the ark up to Israel. Even in these two eras, which were basically patriarchal eras or pilgrim eras, where there was no land and no theocracy, yet the altar was still there. The altar was in effect in those periods. When the altar is destroyed in AD 70, then there's no need for the church to observe the prohibition against blood. The prohibition against blood is an expression of respect for the sanctity and the holiness of the sacrifice of blood upon that altar. AD 70, the altar is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. The blood's already been sacrificed. Now, we in the church age, we also are an altar community, but our altar is not on earth. Our altar is in heaven, the Lamb who was slain. And we gather there every Sunday, on the first day of the week, to that heavenly altar, to that heavenly sanctuary, where we acknowledge the true and final sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But therefore, since the altar is no longer on earth, it isn't necessary to maintain the respect for that sanctity of that altar by abstaining from blood. Is that the question?
That was okay. The only other question I would have is that the apostles did order the Gentiles not to do that.
Right, and that's
where is that, you know, abrogated?
That's because if you take a close-up here of this picture, of this point right here in redemptive history, okay, let's zoom into that point in redemptive history. This is what it looks like. There's a period of time where you have the new covenant